Good evening. I'm Kitty Goddard, president of AIR, Arts Incubator of Richardson. Welcome to season 6 of Airtime. Before I introduce our guest artist for the evening, though, I have a special event that I have to share with you about a citywide arts celebration which is taking place this Saturday in Richardson called Ricochet 15. And also my cohort in crime is here tonight, Laurie Garvey, who is executive director of the Richardson Symphony Orchestra. Laurie, if you would wave. Some people might be able to see you back there. Yes, a round of applause would be nice. AIR and the Richardson Symphony collaborated and received a grant from the City of Richardson Cultural Arts Commission, a 50% grant to fund this project. This is a premier event. We have 12 venues all across the city with all types of arts and creative activities taking place. There are maps, which I'm holding one right here, that are available for you to pick up on the way out if you're interested, that have all the venues and activities. Some of the activities are going to take place right here at Alamo Draft House because they are a really great partner and they know the importance of creativity in one's life. So if you want to see some very cool sidewalk chalk art on Saturday, a ballet company, a coloring station that's for adults and children, then make sure you stop by Alamo Draft House in the afternoon. It'll be a great deal of fun. So enough about Ricochet. Oh, you can find Ricochet on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So look for us there as well for all the updates. Anyway, as I said, welcome to season 6 of Airtime. We are so pleased to have as our guest artist tonight, Todd Fechter, who is the interim dean for the School of Arts, Technology, and Emerging Communication at the University of Texas at Dallas. In his spare time, which I don't think he has much, he is also a professor of computer animation, and you might just see some examples of that tonight. So I will now turn the program and airtime over to our wonderful moderator, Mr. David Fisher and Todd Fechter.
Thank you, Kitty. So like Kitty said, welcome to season 6 of Airtime, presented by AIR, the Arts Incubator of Richardson, in partnership with the fabulous Alamo Draft House Cinema here in Richardson. Airtime is a signature artist interview series featuring artists and creative thinkers in Richardson and in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where artists share about their art and why their creativity makes a difference. I would also extend the invite to come experience Ricochet. There is so much going on in Dallas this weekend. I guess it's just the cooler weather makes everyone want to come out and do cool things. So they're all citywide. There's some great things going on. I'm really excited to welcome our guest this evening. Todd, as Kitty said, is the interim dean for the School of Arts, Technology, and Emerging Communication and an assistant professor of computer animation at UT Dallas. His background is in 3D computer animation, and he's worked in both television and film productions as a freelance modeler. You'll have to tell us what a modeler is. And has led teams of modelers in the planning and creation of all sorts of environments and props. Fechter is currently an assistant professor in 3D computer animation at UT Dallas, where he has worked to integrate his production and computer experience into his teachings with the goal of better preparing students to reach their professional aspirations. And this has included the creation of the first online Arts and Technology Computer Animation Digital Class Material Archive, where students have unlimited access to course materials and examples that allow for off-campus learning and review. We'll come back to that with the questions just a little bit. Fechter's current interests are in continued redesign and growth of the ATEC 3D animation curriculum. Two new courses will focus more on the planning and development of 3D animation rather than the actual execution. Students will then be able to fully realize production timelines and methodologies to focus skills learned in other ATEC courses and create their own complex animation. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Todd Fechter. So everyone refers to the department as ATEC, which stands for Arts, Technology, and Emerging Communication. But those are actually two separate divisions, Arts and Technology, and Emerging Media and Communication. So tell us a little bit about the department and the two divisions and how they overlap and sure. Work together.
So the school as a whole has two, I would say, joined but separate entities, ATEC and EMAC. They're not technically departments, but there is a separation between the two. So the arts and technology side deals more with games, animation, sound design, big data visualization, other visualization methods. The emerging communication side deals with social media, web presence, the ramifications of social media in terms of society, in terms of culture, and various other aspects. So they're different, but they also overlap. So we have a number of students who kind of dabble in both sides.
So they're learning how to do social media, but how to have it very well designed.
That's right.
Or how to make a video, but promote it properly.
That's right.
When I was talking to Todd before the interview, okay, first, can we get the house lights for just a second? Is anyone up in the booth? Yes? Okay. When I was talking to Todd before the interview, we were reminiscing about our early computers in our childhoods, and I remember going over to my father's house, and he had one of the early Radio Shack TRS-80s that not only had a floppy drive, it had a cassette tape drive. So I'm really interested, because I see a lot of different ages. How many people in the audience have never known a household without a computer? So I think the majority of you actually got your first computer at some time in your. So how many people remember their getting that first computer into the house? Okay, well it's not as much of a millennial crowd as
sure.
I expected. So I was also reminded of a class I took in undergraduate school, and part of the coursework had to do with we had to take a class in critical thinking. And just by luck, I got like the cool professor who taught the entire class of critical thinking with video games. And this was a number of years ago. This was before the internet, before I think even Apple. So the entire course was taught with puzzle games. And if you remember that old game where you were flying a B-52 plane
right.
into Russian territory and you had to drop bombs and you had to really think about how would you have enough fuel to get back, what were your coordinates, and you had to sort of plot it out. And so he taught critical thinking through these video games. So while not online learning, I think the class, a lot of what you do has to do with online learning.
Sure.
And I think, I got my MBA back in the early 2000s when online learning was really just a substitute for the classroom experience. And they tried to model the classroom experience, tried to model the online learning after the classroom experience. But how do you think online learning has evolved in the last 10 or 15 years? And how is it more like that cool critical thinking class than it was
right.
25 years ago?
Well, I think in general there's more information available about online learning and how best to approach online learning in terms of your audience, in terms of the types of materials you're trying to teach, and the types of materials that you can actually teach well over online versus those that you need to be in a classroom. As part of ATEC as a whole is looking at those trends and trying to develop new ways of teaching. And to that end, something that you mentioned, we actually do a lot of work with serious games, which are basically designed to teach. So some of our faculty have built games to teach high school students calculus. We've built training simulators for the Army, for soldiers going off to Afghanistan or to Iraq in terms of cultural training, so that they know what to expect and how to interact with people from different cultures once they get into those environments, so they don't go into it blind, that they have some experience.
So it's like Call of Duty, just with more narrative.
Yes, there is no violence, there is no shooting. But there is some level of sophistication where, depending on how you interact with the different, basically the AI that was built into it, how you interact with the different individuals influences how they interact with you in turn, so you can become out of favor very quickly if you don't respond correctly or if you don't understand who you're talking to. So those are the types of things that we're looking at in terms of online learning. It's not just for classroom, but it's also just in general how to provide information or how we can do so many things now that we couldn't do before in terms of technology, in terms of putting people into environments without actually having to place them in a physical environment. And that's also growing with the VR revolution, with things like the Oculus Rift headset displays.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay. basically a head-mounted display that has two separate, you can call them cameras inside, where you can immerse yourself. It's in a 3D environment. You can have interactions. You can interact with just about anything. You can look around 360 degrees. You can also make yourself very sick. So part of that is just overcoming the Q factor, making people nauseous. But all of that technology is coming. So in the next 5 to 10 years, that will be pervasive across everything.
But you're still using, you're still using sociology and history and human dynamics and emotional intelligence and all of those sort of things. You're just writing it into a game.
That's right.
And you're making it beautiful because you're putting good design into it.
I think one of the misconceptions is that just because you're using technology, it's great. There's a lot of technology that isn't utilized properly or is not a good interaction when people try to use it or interact with it. So all the underlying foundations are what you're saying, sociology, psychology, scientific information, scientific studies. In our case, we also have a lot of design questions that we pose in terms of how people interact with something. It's not enough to have something that looks great or functions properly. It's about how someone interacts with it and judging that interaction and modifying to make it a nice experience or a satisfying experience for whoever's using it, whatever that may be.
So you're obviously doing more than just teaching students how to make animation. You're not just teaching them to be artists, but, I mean, my background's in the theater, so we are trained to be storytellers.
Sure.
But now you're really, like I said, involving history and sociology and ultimately translating those lessons into their life lessons. So
sure.
That by telling the story of this person, they say, oh, well, that's just like real life. So do you think students are better or worse prepared for this kind of work today? I mean, I was reading an article that was, for years, you've said, too much screen time for children. And now they're just saying, no, screen time is just time. There is just, screens are part of our lives
sure.
now. So are students different today than they were a decade ago because of this, because of the amount of digital and screen experience they have?
No, I think there's definitely a difference. An interesting article that I just came across, now some of the best future neurosurgeons are video game players. And the reason is because they have better eye hand coordination, they have sophisticated, they develop sophisticated mechanisms just by playing games and repetition and just seeing and not having to interact. So, and also because a lot of that technology is now moving towards virtual simulations of surgery for practice and for whatnot. And I think because everyone is more savvy with technology, it becomes a little bit more difficult. In some cases, technology is not our friend. And I tend to like to, in some cases, remove it to focus on what drives those things in terms of going back to basically the foundations, the fundamentals of either how people learn or just in terms of, like I said, design or in terms of sociological, just ramifications of what we're doing. So,
sometimes it's
very different. It's also students expect more. They're used to having very quick interactions, and they're used to very rapid information coming towards them. Sometimes I think that's a problem because they may not stop to actually evaluate what they're doing and why they're doing it instead of just doing it because it's right there in front of them. They can push it out.
So, I mean, do you sometimes just have to say, okay, out of the computer lab, let's go get some sunlight and touch some trees.
If I could, I would never sit at a computer, and I would force everyone to get away from it and go outside and actually do something physical, build something with your hands or create something, because it's just a tool, and you have to understand what you're actually doing. And I think by doing it that way, you have a better understanding of what it is you're actually doing and how to approach things than if you just have it in front of you and it's just a tool that you're interacting with. And kind of, I think there's a big difference. My background's in industrial design, so before I got into modeling, I used to build physical models out of polystyrene and foam and wood. And there's something about having to actually physically build something that you learn something from. And I also think that there are no undos. So you have to start to become a better planner. You have to start to become smarter about how you approach things. And you can carry that forward into 3D in terms of animation.
So let's take a minute. We have two of Todd's students' films here. Let's go ahead and run those two films.
Kent, those were created this summer over 11 weeks, which is really crazy for animation. So they created both of those shorts as a class, I believe, of 25 to 30 students. And some of the best student work that we've produced to this point. So thank you, guys. It looks great.
So a couple of the students are out here. Raise your hand. So just what do you want to be when you grow up? A producer? Someone else? Lighters? What is a lighter?
A lighter lights the shots. So if you think of 3D animation, everything is dark, it's black, there's nothing in it. So you physically have to create everything, including all the lighting schemes. So it's like stage lighting, it's exactly the same. And they actually go through and place lights that mimic physical lights inside the scenes and set all of their intensity, color value, everything.
When I was in lighting design school, we looked at a lot of Edward Hopper paintings.
Right.
Anyway, who else? Other student? What do you want to be when you grow up? Are you going to be animators? Are you going to continue to work? Or, yep? A lighter? Anyone else? Any other students here? Well, cool. Thank you for being here. So in your bio, you mentioned the creation of the first online computer animation digital class material archive, where students have unlimited access to course materials and examples that allow for a review of this. So this seems to me to be a very cool Montessori sort of approach, where they can be self-directed and sort of pick and choose and go back and spend more time. So how do you, but yet you're also in a university that's going to have standards and checkboxes and things that need to go. So how do you balance that sort of very self-directed, I'm on my own creative journey, with the rigors of academia and having to get a certain number of credits for a degree?
Sure. I think the biggest thing was that when I first came into the university, I knew what I had been taught and how I'd been taught at Ohio State when I was there, and I knew I did not want to do that because it didn't work so well. Actually, it worked okay, but it was because of a lot of outside. So now it's very common. There's a lot of studios, there's a lot of companies online that sell training. You can purchase training and go in and access it whenever you want. But 8 years ago, when I first came to the university, we created our own with the idea of allowing students to have access to this material all the time. So we would go through and basically create our lecture series or create projects, post all that up onto a website, which didn't really exist at the time, elsewhere. And then students would access that for the class, do all their work outside of the class, and then when they come back into the class, we can have discussions instead of trying to show this is how this tool works and this is how this works, which is not, there's no real point to that. It defeats the purpose of understanding why you're doing something instead of just learning what button to push and how to move this around. So that's kind of where all that came from. And it also helps because in our school, we have 1,300 students right now. Not all are animation students, there's gaming students. But when you have that number of students, you have to be able to provide information on a large scale and have consistency. So one of the ideas was by doing this, we could offer multiple sections of our courses, have students having a certain standard that's been set. So when they come into projects like you just saw, we know what we can expect, and they know what the bar is, and it's not taught by one individual one way and someone else. So there has to be that consistency.
Cool, thank you. So leading into the film that we're going to see tonight, The Matrix, which was, believe it or not, 1999.
I know, it's crazy.
I mean, even The Matrix has sort of become a term just in our vocabulary as a sort of simulated reality or even a sort of broader overreaching meta-reality. And realizing that the work of computer animation is both artistic and technical and storytelling. So I was sort of thinking about the whole notion of glitches in the Matrix. And there are those moments that you see them in the movie where something just isn't right, where something doesn't add up, or something just isn't real, and you sort of realize that something, the record has, who knows what records are? I was going to say the record is skipped, but who knows what records are? That something has skipped and that there's something out of whack. However, going back to the thing we saw here, I mean, airplanes don't act like that. They don't do that. But so we have to sort of suspend our disbelief, that old notion of I mean, when I was on stage and worked in film, there was this notion of suspension of disbelief that we would see the wires on Peter Pan, but we would still believe that he was flying. So we watch anime, but when we watch bad animation or problematic animation, and we see something that just doesn't move right, it doesn't work right, how do you teach your students to create these unreal, imaginative, innovative, creative, out of this world kind of things, but still have to adhere to the laws of physics, the laws of the matrix, so that we as viewers don't say, wait, there's something not right there?
So there's something called the uncanny valley, and everyone knows what it is, even if you don't know what the term is. So if you watch a film and you see something, a visual effect, or they try to replicate a live human being, and you look at it and say something's not quite right, that's the uncanny valley, where everyone has a perception of real people, because we deal with real people all the time, so if the walk isn't right, if their eyes aren't right, you'll notice it. And the best example that I use is the Avatar. You've seen the movie Avatar, which most people have. There's a reason the aliens are blue, and it's because if they tried to make them look like us, we would reject it. But because they are different enough, we buy the fact that, oh, those are aliens. I believe that they're there, or at least I know they're fake, but I believe it for the terms of this movie. So one of the first things that we try to do is when to use animation and when to go shoot something live. And people's expectations. So when you see something like we just saw, keyframe animation, which is traditional Disney animation, if you're going to be animating something, we try to push our students to actually push the animation, to take advantage of the medium they're trying to use, and use it to its best potential, which is usually not to try to replicate something exact, but to push it and to try to add character, in this case, to a plane. In terms of something like Jurassic Park, you're looking at trying to replicate something that people know for fact. So that when they look at reference of birds running, like ostrich running for a gallimimus, everything is tied back to some kind of reference point, something that anyone in the audience can look at, and they know it kind of feels like something I know is real, and they pull that into it yourself. And that's why when you get some of these characters that are completely alien, where there's no recognizable facial features, and there's no one knows what to make of it, you just kind of flat out reject it from the beginning.
The uncanny valley.
The uncanny valley. I try to avoid it.
So I want to take it out for any questions, for questions to the audience.
This is just like one of our classes. Everyone's very quiet.
There'll be extra credit.
Any student questions?
In the back over here, 3703.
We are.
The question was, we're talking about virtual reality. Is Todd doing any work with augmented reality?
Right.
So is that right, augmented?
That's correct. Yeah, we are doing some work with augmented reality. One of the biggest applications for that right now is in the area of history, where you can walk out to an historical site and basically reenact or recreate the environment around you. What's great about this is you need nothing physical to really do this, but you could walk up to the Alamo, let's say, and holding up a mobile device, help your iPad, your phone, you'd be able to see what it would look like back then, and it's basically tracking live markers or live objects through your viewfinder, and it's superimposing on top of that digital information. What's great about that is you can basically add anything that you want, and moving forward, that's how people are going to interact with just about everything, where you're gonna have the ability to put objects into scenarios using your virtual device or your tablet or whatever it is, and have all this information on the fly and be able to access all of it. It's gonna be crazy.
What's your advice for students who are interested in going to your program at UTD?
Advice for students who want to go to the program at UTD.
Oh man, students are going to get sick of hearing this. I think the biggest thing is to realize that to make something like you just saw, or to work on games or anything in general, takes a lot of work. Sometimes in our students we notice the work ethic isn't there. And if you know our faculty, if you're in our school, we work people over pretty good, because that's what it takes to be good in this type of field. In any of these competitive technology fields, you have to be doing something that's innovative. You have to be pushing yourself. It's not good enough just to sit there and kind of go through the motions, and yeah, I'm learning some things, but what can you do with it? How are you taking your ideas and bringing them into these tool sets. So I think it's just being very proactive. It's being a type A personality. It's not being afraid to speak up. It's working with other students, not trying to work by yourself, try to be on campus, try to be in the labs. And this is where online education to me has some gaps yet, because I can take 15 students, put them in a room, give them a project, they can hash it out, and they're developing a critical skill, which is interaction and people skills. Because at some point, you're probably gonna have to get a job, you're probably gonna have to go work someplace and interact with other people. And if you cannot do that, it doesn't matter how good you are in anything, you will fail. At least that's what we kind of preach inside of ATEC.
So you have 1,300, you said 1,300 students.
Yes.
How many schools are there like yours?
Exactly like ours, not very many.
Or similar.
Similar, there's a handful. It's becoming more prevalent. We're a little bit different in that the way our school has been structured, we're trying to look forward instead of mimicking what's going on right now. So in terms of animation, which is a really simple example, there's a lot of schools who go through an animation program. What they're doing is creating a pipeline to industry where students come in, you earn XYZ, and they put you out into go find work. But everyone's geared the same. Whereas our school, what we do is we offer all these different areas and we allow students to come in and tell us what they would like to be doing. And if they're not quite sure, we expose them to a number of different core courses. And then from those, they can start to pick and choose which direction they're gonna go. So it's almost a kind of create or cater your own degree program to some extent. There's certain things that everyone has to take. But from that, what happens is we get stronger collaboration because we get students who are in games, animation, EMAC, working together on projects, and that's where some of the really unique ideas come from, and some of the most valuable. Entrepreneurship is also something that's very large for us in terms of we want our students to be able to create exciting new things to do with technology, but then also to be able to market them and sell them so that they can become, you know, ideally.
Rich and famous.
Well, yeah. I mean, everyone wants to be rich and famous, I guess, but yeah.
And artistically satisfied.
That's right.
More questions. Bruce?
So, great pieces of work. Copyright. School owns it, the students own it. How does it, if it's perfect and it could be marketed, who has the rights to that?
Question on who has the rights to the films we just saw, the school or the students?
So this is where it gets a little bit tricky, but as far as our university is concerned, creative works, they don't really lay ownership or claim ownership. So in this case, it's a creative work created by these students. So as far as we're concerned, these students are co-owners of this project. The university can use it for its purposes, for marketing the school, for highlighting the students, for drawing new students into the school. But a lot of these students are also gonna take this piece, put it onto their demo reels, and they're applying to Pixar, Pixar is actually coming out twice in the next 2 months. And a lot of them, I'm sure, are gonna be showing this work to them. And that's the benefit to them, is they have these projects, it's theirs, they can submit it to festivals, and we submit it to festivals on their behalf. But the university itself doesn't try to clamp down on it and claim it and say, you can't take it and run with it. They've created it, it's their thing, we've provided the labs and we provide the technology and whatnot, and the university side of that is basically let us use that to promote ourselves and to grow our program and entice new students to come in.
Or here in the second room.
From storyboard to finished product, how many different departments or skills are used? You know, I know that there's riggers and there's lighting people. And
sure.
But can you kind of identify what that means?
Sure.
Let me just repeat for the audio. From storyboard to finished product, how many different departments or divisions or areas of work are there in the process?
So it's usually broken out into three major areas. There's pre-production, production, and post-production. Pre-production would be your design, storyboards, art, sometimes what's called story reel, where you do the first cut of the film. Storyboards are basically the crude little drawings that we'll cut together because it's quicker than actually trying to make anything in the computer. Plus, we can make mistakes and it doesn't cost any money, really, to do it. Then it moves into layout, which is where you take the storyboards and have to put them digitally. And this is for computer animation, I should say. But layout takes those boards and basically recreates those in the computer using proxy geometry, really crude, rudimentary geometry with cameras, which act as physical cameras that we can move around, we can create camera movements, cuts, edits. Then modeling, which is where the geometry is built, which is where my area of expertise has been. Shading and texturing, which is where we make the objects look like leather or plastic or wood. Rigging, which is where they articulate the characters so they can move around. Animation, who takes the rigs and animates them. Lighting, who takes all the animated shots with the models in it, creates the digital lighting setup. Then you have VFX, which is basically the visual effects, who do fire, wind, rain, anything that's procedurally generated, usually called simulation. And then you have rendering and compositing, which is where all the bits, usually when you make something like you saw up there, it's rendered out, and rendering is where you create the final images. It's made in probably 50 or 60 little pieces. So what character, let's say, of the airplane has a shadow pass, potentially. It has a color pass, it has a lighting pass, it has an occlusion pass, which is a little bit of shadowing. So all these different images get stacked up inside this composite, and that's how we go and then can modify each individual piece without having to re-render it. So it's a lengthy process. There's probably at least 8 really separate groups that work on it as a whole, but they're all in constant communication because you can't make a decision in one without affecting somebody else. So usually the front end has to know what the back end plans on doing and how much time they have. Otherwise, the back end is not going to like the front end.
How many people were on those little films?
I believe we had 25 students, and they all worked on both. So we had different groups, and I think we had like 9 modelers, let's say. We had, I think, 8 animators, something like that. We had 5 lighters, and they all move around. We don't allow them just to do one thing. We force them to have to do more than one thing, because otherwise they get too comfortable.
But as a bit of perspective, you had 25 students work 11 weeks on 3 minutes
yes.
of film.
Yes. Just in general, animation is not time efficient. It takes a long time to create something. So your Pixar films, your Disney films, they usually take 4 to 5 years to create, with the first 3 years being story development, maybe about a year and a half of production, and $250 million to pay for everything and everybody. That's why they have to make money.
Question over here.
Yes, Todd. Do you ever start with a hand-drawn set of thumbnails?
Yes.
You start with hand-drawn thumbnails.
So right now, actually, kind of a plug. No, we're doing a piece. Myself and 2 other professors have our own little studio that we've started. We're doing a piece for the Alamo Draft House to be kind of show you how to Alamo, let's say. When we do something like that, I tend to like to do everything by hand. I don't like digital drawings. It doesn't have character, right? So I want to do it fast.
Yeah, and a race.
And I don't want to have technology in front of me and all this stuff. I just want to do it really quick, get my ideas out there, judge them, see if they're any good. If they're not, throw them away. I didn't spend any time on it. So we always start with little tiny thumb boards, I call them, which are just, no one else could probably look at them and make out what they are, but to me it's my shorthand. From there we move a little bit forward, get a little bit more storyboards going, but that's the way I approach everything, not just animation, but just ideas in general. I have to start with little quick sketches and kind of get it out of my head.
We heard what students wanted to be when they grow up. What does Todd want to be when he grows up?
Oh, man. I didn't know I was going to be interim dean. So that was kind of thrust upon me in January of last year. What I want to be, I just want to create stuff. Right now it's animation, so just creating stuff in general. I'm a creative person. I get complacent very easily if I'm doing the same things over and over. So just making ideas, putting stuff out there, filmmaking, not so much in the video games, but also there's some ideas there. It's more storytelling, it's more just having some kind of outlet to put my own materials out. That's the short answer, I guess.
Final question.
So you can't just do this on your own. You have to have a team. When you do one of these, do you pick a team that's going to work with you?
It depends on what you're doing. So it's like anything else. It's scalable. So when you look at a Disney film, let's say, there's probably 250 people who worked on that at various stages, not all throughout. Some of the things that you can do with one person. It may take you longer. One person could not make something that looks like a Pixar film unless they had a couple thousand years to do it because of time. And that's literal. I'm not joking. Because of all the time it takes to do something. So you can do things with smaller teams and with individuals, but you have to understand what that means for your project. So you have to know how much money you have. You have to know how much time you have to put into it. And this is all stuff that we work with the students on as well, because at the end of the day, you want to be able to finish it. That's the biggest thing, is be able to finish it, put it out there. So you have to find the best medium to do what you want in the best way that you can, given what you have in front of you.
Well, thanks, Todd. We are done with questions and running out of time, so we're going to finish up with an airtime tradition called the Top 10 Shorts. So okay. I have 10 questions for you that you will give your quickest, off the top of your head, answer.
Oh, this could be bad.
Question one, night owl or morning person?
Morning person.
Question two, Elvis or the Beatles?
Elvis.
Question three, if it's not Elvis or the Beatles, what's your third choice?
Oh, man. I don't even have one. I don't know. You caught me off guard. Wayne Newton.
Oh. Question four, Mac or PC?
PC.
Question five, what one film should everyone see at least once in their life?
Jaws.
Question six, what is the film that you could watch over and over and over again?
Batman.
Which one?
89.
Number seven, the language you don't but wish you could speak?
Dutch.
Number eight, what's the one bit of advice you'd give your 18-year-old self?
Oh, man. What would I say to my 18-year-old self? I can't say. Watch your sarcasm.
Number nine, an upcoming film you're most looking forward to?
Krampus. Yes.
And number 10, your favorite thing to do that has nothing to do with electronics, video games, or animation?
Watch my kids play soccer.
Very good. Everyone, please join me in thanking our guests for their time today. Mr. Carpenter.
And I have to echo those thanks. Todd, that was really fascinating, and not that I knew much to begin with, but I know a lot more now. Anyway, thanks, and thanks for bringing the two short films by your students.
Sure.
Students, you did a fabulous job. So glad you could be here. I want to remind you one more time, Ricochet, Saturday, and I mentioned that there would be events here at Alamo Draft House. Guess where else there will be events? You got it, University of Texas at Dallas in the ATEC building. Because they're one of our partners as well. So if you want to see some examples of student-created video games that you can go and play, head to the ATEC lobby. They're also going to be having an example of motion capture technology, as well as some representatives from Arts and Humanities doing some of the more fluid productions like theater, dance, and visual arts. Anyway, we've so appreciated your being here tonight. I wanted to remind you the next airtime is November the 11th, and it will be Jenny and Kevin Galvan, who are the owners and proprietors of Haystack Burgers and Barley, which happen to be neighbors here of Alamo. They have a very interesting story as to their connection to Alamo, and the movie will be Tortilla Soup, and if you come to the interview, you will hear why we picked Tortilla Soup. So we hope to see you in November, and please enjoy The Matrix. Thanks.